This is Wade's World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come visit me on the east side of town?
This is Wade Rathke, and you're listening to Wade's World, a Voice of the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay, points north and south, east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at kabf.org and acornradio.org. A podcast will be available of the show on these websites and at affiliatedmediamovement.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world, and today we're talking to Melinda Lowry, who's a professor in North Carolina at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, the big one. And more importantly, perhaps today, she's the director of the Center for the Study of the American South. We're talking about her new book, The Lumbee Indians, An American Struggle. Professor Lowry, welcome to Wade's World.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure.
Glad to be part of the world.
There you go.
Sounds fun.
Okay, so look, this is not your first book on the Lumbee Indians, but this is not a group that a lot of people know as big as it is on the east part of the Mississippi River. So why don't you give us some background on the Lumbee?
Sure. Lumbees are actually the largest tribe east of the Mississippi, about 55,000 people, headquartered in southeastern North Carolina, which is much of it right now is underwater, or water has just recently left it. And our ancestors come from the hundreds of villages that lay between southern Virginia and the northern part of what is now South Carolina. We migrated to our current homeland over the course of several hundred years after Europeans arrived, and the processes of disease and warfare and slavery began to decimate the original people that lived on that land, and the survivors came together, and many of them moved to what is now Robeson County, North Carolina, to be part of the Indian community that we believe already lived there.
But
we've
this
been
is
in
not...
that site for about 300 years.
So a lot of people, and this is largely because of the way the country is developed, believe all Indians are on a reservation. But there is no reservation per se for the Lumbee, is there?
No, and that's because around the time of the American Revolution, my ancestors, I'm a member of the tribe, my ancestors acquired title to their land as individuals, so they were private landowners since around the founding of the United States. And that meant that the United States government, nor the state of North Carolina, had much right or title to do anything with our land. We could do what we wanted to with it because we owned it privately. And that's quite different than the histories of other tribes and other places.
Although certainly the Lumbee weren't immune or exempted from land grabbing, were they?
No, not really. The way we experienced it was much more as a kind of legal erasure than a physical erasure. So the Trail of Tears, you know, which unfolded in the South in the 1830s mostly, happened because the tribes that were subject to removal owned their land in common or collectively, and so the federal government could make treaties with those tribal leaders to remove them from those lands. And the background of those treaties is, you know, highly contaminated by corruption. In our case, we faced a different type of corruption around the same time, and that was kind of the corruption of race and racial hierarchies. So after the American Revolution, the state of North Carolina began to call us free people of color and deny our rights as free people because we were non-white. And we African Americans faced the same kind of treatment if they were free and non-white. And so a good deal of property between the American Revolution and the Civil War was sort of taken from Lumbee's hands, though some of it legal and some of it illegal. Some of it was the result of economic deprivations and legal laws passed that prevented us from thriving economically and being able to hold on to that land by virtue of the fact that we were called free people of color and didn't have distinct rights as Native people during that time.
Although you do mention one of the sort of ironies is that as the years went by, at different times, members of your family, I think your grandfather, if I'm remembering correctly, was at one point classified by perhaps the census in 1900 as white, and then 1910 he was,
Right, he kept switching back and forth. Yeah, my great-grandfather.
They couldn't decide what was going on.
And,
all they knew is that they were glad to discriminate against the Lumbee.
Well, it's sort of, I think, the problem with racial labels and racial categories is that they tend to support a hierarchy, right? So you don't need racial categories unless you're really going to rank people by those categories. And so that's part of what the U.S. Census was doing at that time. Was 1900 he was called Indian, in 1910 he was called white, in 1920 he was called Indian. And the Indian label for us was a way to affirm our autonomy in a world that was otherwise black and white, you know, in a world that otherwise seemed like only two races belonged. Indian for us in 1900 was a way to mark our difference and to support our independence as a community. And in 1910, when a white label, or for any other Lumbee, when another label was used, it was sort of a means of saying, you know, we're not going to recognize you. We're not going to make you see you for who you are. We're going to call you something else. And so almost no matter what the label was, whether it was white or mulatto or Negro, it came along with problems of belonging to this kind of racial hierarchy.
And that's part of what's going on now. I mean, we're sort of jumping around between 300 years ago and 1900 and 1920, but there's certainly a huge debate about race now in this country, and how do the Lumbee navigate that problem?
Well, you can't really talk about it without talking about history. So around 1900, Lumbees were beginning to ironically take advantage of racial segregation. One of the things that is fascinating but also troubling about our history is the way in which when the logic of Jim Crow and racial segregation came along, many of our ancestors decided that it was an opportunity. So rather than openly resist it, they did resist it in some ways, but rather than sort of say, insist early on the integration of the races, they decided that they would take advantage of this as a way to assert their independence as a Native community. And instead of going to school with whites or blacks, they figured out how to found schools of their own for Indians. And so today, that approach to race relations is very much still with us. I mean, over time, we've very much collaborated with whites and blacks around issues that were of mutual interest, such as integration. When that came around, you had some Lumbees who were very much in favor of that and wanted to cooperate with African Americans to secure equal access to schools and the political process. You also had Lumbees in the 1960s and 70s who very much resisted integration because they wanted to maintain that control over their own communities, and they saw integration as a way to lose control. Today, of course, we are able to accept that the world is not just black and white, you know, that Southern society is not just, people don't just belong to two races, but that philosophy of kind of autonomy still hangs on in the Lumbee community as a way to say, still argue for the recognition that we feel we deserve. Part of it is being able to acknowledge, for outsiders, being able to acknowledge that we were here before the United States was here, and, you know, that doesn't always accord with, racial integration in every sense of the word. Sometimes people want to maintain a separate status, but again, not so much because of racial backgrounds, but because of a political autonomy that Native Americans have because their nations predate the existence of the United States.
Well, in the separate and equal period, when there were separate Lumbee schools, were those supported by the state, county, or federal government, or how were they financed?
Yeah, they were. Initially, of course, the state passed a law in 1885 saying that the Lumbees, our ancestors then were called Croatan Indians, were Native American, recognized us as Indian, and a law a few years later afforded us a separate school because state government was not going to allow us to go to school with whites. And Indians did not want to go to school with blacks or whites. We wanted to go on our own. And so that law, or that set of laws, kind of opened the doorway for state financing of these public Indian schools. At first, of course, for about the first 30 years or so, Indians were financing their own schools. And not a lot of people were getting education at this time in North Carolina at all. But Indians were kind of building and financing their own schools. It was finally in the early 20th century that we began to get support for that endeavor from the state.
Now, by the time you were raised, you were obviously, well, I'm not. Nothing's obvious anymore, is it? But by the time you were raised, what was the school situation then?
Well, I was born in 1972, so
okay, so that was post Brown.
It was post Brown, and I've only realized since researching this book heavily in the last 5 years how slow integration proceeded, not only in Robeson County but in the community I grew up in the city of Durham, about 2 hours away. Brown was 1954, but according, in some communities, it took well into the 1970s to begin to really integrate. And it was only about 4 years before I was born that the public schools in Robeson County began a serious effort to comply with a federal court order to develop an integration plan. So I went to the public schools in Durham, but many of my cousins and people of my own generation who attended school in Robeson County, some of them still went to predominantly Indian schools. My aunts and uncles happened to be the first Native people to integrate a white school in the town of Robeson County, and that was in the late 60s. So, you know, it was a very, very slow process, and I think we're still seeing today how difficult and fraught it is, especially when people who have been disadvantaged by that system of segregation are looking at an integrated system and still seeing the same disadvantages, or at least similar kinds of disadvantages.
Absolutely, and unfortunately, those of us with some, you know, who are a little bit long in the tooth know that it was only in the middle late 60s that any schools were really segregated. I lived
right.
in New Orleans at that time, my high school, because of, you know, some curious circumstances. I guess what was called a magnet school at this time was the first one to be integrated in New Orleans at that time when I first enrolled. But so we're talking to Professor Melinda Lowry about her new book, The Lumbee Indians, An American Struggle. Let's talk about this problem you just sort of knocked on the door, this problem of recognition. So way back, the North Carolina legislature obviously did recognize the fact that the Lumbee were a Native tribe in this area, but in terms of federal recognition, this has been a struggle.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see it in the light of how the federal government has kind of changed its mind over the years about this, as if it had a mind. But it's
we can't go there. This is only a half-hour show,
I know.
Professor.
I know. But the collective policies or the approaches towards American Indian recognition have changed a lot over the years. And so that doesn't make it any easier. In the Lumbee case, and every tribe, too, has a somewhat different relationship to this history. So in the Lumbee case, the federal government has said since we first petitioned for federal recognition in the 1880s that we are Indians. Either it said so directly or it said so indirectly by reference to other kinds of policies related to Indians. But it's always affirmed that we are an Indian group. What the federal government has not yet done is say we are going to acknowledge the government-to-government relationship that your tribe has with the United States. And federal recognition is, some people think of it as a racial preference, you know, because they believe that American Indians are members of a racial group, which in some cases that's true. I mean, it's useful when you're thinking about the census to, for example, to think of us as a racial group. But then when you're thinking about acknowledgement or recognition, really the legal issue comes down to American Indians as defined as political communities. So we're nations with citizens, and that makes the United States a kind of nation of nations. And the United States federal government has always had a big problem, not just with the Lumbees, but in lots of other places and time periods, trying to figure out how to reckon with these nations within their borders and how to treat them fairly and appropriately.
They have, correct?
At the level of what, sorry?
Sovereignty that they have. I mean, clearly
exactly.
There are different tax arrangements, police forces in some cases.
Economic opportunities.
Casinos are certainly the, you know, front page headline in terms of if you're in the West, you know, you just passed reservation boundaries because there's a casino coming up,
right.
It seems like,
healthcare,
in New Mexico. Healthcare,
education.
The Indian Health Service, which is another scandal. We could probably talk about it another time. But... this is, was this a change? Did it change in the Obama administration? I thought I saw something in your book where there seemed to be a light opening for a while in terms of the long, multi-year delays of the government even processing the procedures to make a decision on recognition.
Yeah, it's a little too complicated to explain right now, but during the Obama administration, we did have a shift in how the federal government was going to approach the Lumbee case. And part of that came through a political arrangement between our tribal leaders and members of Congress. So the Bureau of Indian Affairs is one avenue to federal recognition for tribes that do not already possess it. The other one is asking Congress to pass a law, essentially, acknowledging the tribe and its sovereign relationship to the United States. And in the Obama administration, we had an opening that we thought might allow us to get such a law passed, but it quickly became kind of convoluted, as you alluded to earlier, in the gaming conversation. Congress, at least in our case, is very much against proposing a Lumbee recognition bill that allows us to also pursue gaming. You know, again, we're just layers upon layers of double standards here. Recognition itself is a kind of double standard, like why do Indians have to justify their existence
exactly.
in the United States? But then they're applying a second double standard to Lumbees when other tribes who possess recognition or possess it in different forms have the right to pursue gaming. Why wouldn't you give it to the Lumbee tribe? You know, and there's a real complicated set of reasons there, but one of them is that Congress is not typically very knowledgeable about Indian affairs, and they would prefer a kind of cookie cutter, like one size fits all approach to policy. But in what we see with Lumbee history is it's been extremely difficult for Congress to afford American Indian tribes the respect they deserve, especially around their different historical and political circumstances. So while Obama's presidency offered an opening, ultimately we were not able to be successful in that era. So it's still an ongoing issue.
And the obvious irony is, you know, embedded in the comments you made when we were first on the air, is the size of the Lumbee compared to, unfortunately, many of the other tribes that have received recognition. You're talking about 55,000 people in the Lumbee community at large. Some of these recognitions and some of these casinos are on in situations where the tribe is hardly several thousand.
Yeah, and that's, you know, those are tribes that in particular, I think many Lumbees that I've talked to would say, you know, we're business owners, we have attorneys, doctors, elected officials that are members of our community, members of our group. We also own our land privately, so we can do a lot of things with our land that Native people on reservations simply cannot do because of the legal
exactly.
arrangement of
mm-hmm.
the land. So, you know, Lumbees are looking for recognition partly for the economic opportunities it provides. I mean, we want to be able to kind of fully create new opportunities under our control for ourselves, but also our neighbors. I mean, we can't forget that we're living alongside, right next to every other kind of American. in our rural community in North Carolina. And so our economic prosperity, we recognize, benefits everybody. But for us, too, it's a matter of fairness, and for once after these, you know, many, many decades, to be able to say we do not have to continue to justify our existence on this land, even though we were here before anybody else was, is simply a matter of being able to say, you know, finally the federal government did something right for indigenous people within its borders.
And we need to start making a list of what the federal government is doing right these days. So it'd be nice to see them on the right side of the line. We're talking to Professor Lowry, who's written what I believe is not only an interesting but important book called The Lumbee Indians, An American Struggle. Now, you live, you mentioned having gone to school in Durham. Durham is one of those blue spots on the map, Austin and,
sure,
you know, Madison, yeah, and whatever. It's one of the more liberal communities in the larger South. But when you talk about Robinson County and that area where so many Lumbee were concentrated, I know we did a study with another organization I'm part of on rural electric cooperatives.
Mm-hmm.
And for all the representation that Lumbee may have in other areas, the cooperative in that area was certainly not what you would call diverse.
Right. And that was the subject of a lawsuit, as I recall, a few years ago. I'm not as familiar on that case, but
I'm not going to hawk talk. I don't remember every detail, but Pembroke and some of the names in your book, I said, "Oh, I wish I had time to look back on that before I call the professor," because as I recall, it was one of those sort of jumped out and was a little bit of a mess.
Was, and we do struggle certainly with local representation issues, and especially when it comes to structural discrimination of lots of kinds. I've written more in the book about law enforcement and the collusion between law enforcement and drug trafficking and how that has negatively impacted,
exactly,
again, not just Lumbees, but also African Americans and whites in our community.
But it also has to do with this embedded hierarchy of race that you're talking about, doesn't it?
Well, somewhat, but it's not really that simple, because a lot of the people profiting from that collusion were also Lumbees. Lumbees were the major drug trafficking agents in the county in the 1980s. And so that, you know, Lumbees were not simply victims of a corrupt law enforcement system. They were also participants in the law enforcement system and profited from it. The problem is, you know, you can't have this, that type of greed doesn't mean, you know, adequate distribution of wealth. Greed and corruption just promotes more inequality, and the reason for citizens, you know, being involved in law enforcement and watching what police and their elected officials are doing is so that economic prosperity can be spread to more than just a few individuals. And that's to me why that particular period of history and the story of structural discrimination really matters. Individuals are subject to discrimination, but it's also that whole communities are suffering and not benefiting because these kinds of inequalities are existing in the ways that money flows, you know.
And we see that problem writ large now across all of American society.
I think,
Professor,
so, yeah.
This question of recognition, though, has to be part of what spurred this book. Are you hoping that it has that kind of impact, or that we can see some change even in the kind of Congress we have now? What's our best hope here?
Well, I talked, when I was in the middle of drafting the book, I had a meeting on Capitol Hill with some of the staff of the senators that represent our state, and they were enthusiastic, looking forward to the book coming out, because what they would like to see is a kind of accessible narrative of Lumbee history that they can use as they explain to their colleagues on the Hill what this legislation is that they're advocating for. That wasn't really a motivation so much as it was I hope it can be a kind of byproduct or
right,
happy byproduct of this work. I mean, I think that the decision about recognition is in the hands of really so few people compared to, you know, the wider American democratic process, that if this work can influence them, that's great. But also, it really, I hope, will alter the way folks look at Native people in their own midst, you know, in their own communities. Because this, the book tells the story of Lumbees over 300 years up until the present day. And mostly in American history books and in school, we're taught that Americans are long ago, and Native Americans are long ago and far away, not with us right now. And so even my daughter, who's 11 and in public schools here in Durham, she's not learning anything about not only her Lumbee history, she's not learning anything about Native history in her school. She's also not learning about Native people in the present. And, you know, her classmates, she encounters questions about what are you and what's an Indian, and well, I've never heard of that. And that's the kind of thing that is, you know, not only damaging to her potentially, or, you know, might cause her to doubt herself or question herself, but it also, you know, signals to students that they're not getting the full story. So when they come to my class in college, they don't know anything about American Indians, and they're quite shocked to learn that American Indian people are still here. So that larger visibility question is closer to my heart as I was writing the book.
Well, and it's certainly important. You wrote an op-ed that was published in the New York Times that I want to bring up. I mean, I remembered reading it because I'm a daily subscriber, but also they sent me a copy of it. And it you wrote this at the time that Charlottesville was very much in the news and the whole issue of Confederate monuments. But I'd like you to share that with our listeners, if you could.
Yeah, so in May or June of this year, it surfaced for me what I, as a Native person, had to say about Confederate monuments. As a young person, I'd kind of been told that was some other person's story. Just ignore it. You know, it's not really part of you. But then I realized after Charlottesville especially that, it wasn't, that's not the case. Presence of monuments
in
our society.
We'd all like to run from that. We really can't.
We don't have to run from it, and we can't, because the presence of these monuments tell a distorted version of our past and therefore a distorted version of our present. If we can't get the past right, we're not going to understand who belongs in this society now, and who has the right to be at the table making decisions in this society now. As long as those monuments are up where they are, they're going to, it's a strong signal that people, well, in this case, people of color are not welcome as part of civil society. And that's just, first of all, it's not true. It doesn't accord with our ethics as a nation. And in university context, which is where I am, it certainly does not meet our educational mission. And that's not how people operate, but having that symbol in our face and somebody like me not saying anything about it is just furthers the kind of mentality that does not allow people the access to the table that they deserve, because they are American citizens like everyone else, students and faculty, members of that university community. So I wanted to kind of provide a Native perspective on the Civil War and to a certain extent what those statues mean. What I wound up talking about in the article was really how Native people have been suspicious of both the South and the North for different reasons, especially during that historical time period, and how all Americans, that project of elevating one race over another is part of the imperialism and colonialism that is unfortunately still going on in our society. It's not like it's in the past. And so I wanted to use Native history to kind of explain how imperialism and colonialism is still with us. And it's still very present in these symbols, and we need to see them for what they are, not, you know, a simplified or simplistic narrative of honor or lost causes or other kinds of things. Those are important. Certainly honoring veterans and honoring soldiers, I believe in that. I have an ancestor who's a Confederate veteran who's a Lumbee also. But I also have ancestors who openly resisted the Confederacy. And nobody really, as an individual, can simply sit on one side of the issue or another without, you know, some implication in their history.
And it's shrouding people in invisibility, which is part of your point. I've got to let you tell people how they can get this book, The Lumbee Indians, An American Struggle. We have Melinda Lowry, the professor who wrote this. How do they find out more about the Lumbee? How can they find their book, your book?
Thank you. They can go to uncpress.org to purchase the book. They can also get it at any bookseller or online website. To find out more about the Lumbees, I would recommend signing up for a Google alert.
There you go.
You know, that really, that where Lumbee is the keyword, because you can get news articles, you can get videos, you can get all kinds of things posted on the internet that way. But also LumbeeTribe.com is our tribal government's website, and they are putting out information that's pertinent to tribal members and events like Hurricane Florence and other things. So I think following the news is one of the good ways.
Excellent, and good luck for everybody on Hurricane Florence. Thank you much, Professor. This has been Wade's World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. As the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week when we'll have another guest, this is Wade Rathke from Wade's World.
This program is produced by the Arkansas Broadcasting Foundation, KABF-FM in Little Rock, Arkansas, and is distributed through Affiliated Media Foundation Movement, AMFM, serving the needs and interests of low and moderate income Americans.